I mean, I come from a generation which went through hell. And I think anybody looks at Buddy or looks at me and goes, God, that guy's got war wounds. And I feel like people have to listen to me. And they have to listen to Buddy because he's legit. Because he's seen such shit. He's seen war. No matter what, people just have to go, you got to give it to the guy. He's been there. And I think that's a lot of it. So it's kind of an exciting time for me. It's like a superpower to be like a middle-aged white guy who's allowed to talk, say whatever I want as Buddy. And that's very, very powerful right now.
One of the most influential comedians of our time has been Scott Thompson with his work on Kids in the Hall. The pioneering sketch comedy show where five friends every week cross-dressed into outrageous characters. And his creation of Buddy Cole, the acid-tongued gay socialite who can get away with saying anything.
America needs help now more than ever to get us through these divisive, turbulent times. America needs a savior. America needs a hero. America needs Buddy Cole. Help us, Buddy! You're our only hope! Today, comedian Scott Thompson joins us to talk about his iconic character, the re-release of Buddy Cole's biography, Buddy Babylon, and his new hit show, Après le Déluge, After the Flood, the Buddy Cole monologues.
Listen as Scott kikis with us about being a PST diva.
His close friendships with all the kids in the hall.
Being pink-listed.
If there will be a Kids in the Hall reunion.
And a cosplay reenactment between Scott Thompson's Ambassador Toman and Captain Janeway on Star Trek Voyager. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Brian Sweeney.
And this is Feast of Fun. Engage. There's comedy in that nebula.
Oh!
That's good comedy.
That's good Star Trek Voyager. That's good dilithium.
That's good nebula.
That's good isolinear chips. That's a good positronic matrix.
And you guys thought you were going to listen to an interview with Scott Thompson.
We don't even know who that is.
Who? Scott Thompson? Who's that?
We have Robbie Thompson.
You mean Scott?
Feast of Fun is made possible because of the support of fierce, fabulous people like you. Become a member and listen to 14 years of amazing podcasts at feastoffun.com/plus. Or put a tip in our tip jar and make a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate. Thank you for your support.
Hello?
Hi, is this Scott Thompson?
Yeah, it is. How you doing?
Hi, Scott. This is Fausto Fernos.
Hi there.
Hello, Scott. This is Brian Sweeney.
Hi, Brian. Hello.
Welcome to Feast of Fun.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
And welcome back, Charles Butterick Cole. Buddy Cole, one of your most endearing characters ever.
Thank you. Yes, he's very glad to be back.
What does it feel like to step back into this iconic character that you created after all these years?
It's not that weird for me because I've always been doing him. I never stopped doing Buddy. I mean, I'm always doing one person shows, and so I've continued to write Buddy Cole monologues ever since the Kids in the Hall ended, and that's what the show is actually. It's monologues written since the Kids in the Hall went off the air.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing now is it's such a polarized time, and everybody is so thin-skinned that Buddy's having a heyday because he doesn't give a fuck, and he just tramples on everybody's sensitivities. And it's joyous because no one's doing it anymore. And so it feels like I've got the whole field is open to me. So it's quite exciting.
This is Après le Déluge, After the Flood, the show that you're touring with. And why do you think Buddy Cole is able to get away with saying outrageous things?
Well, there's different reasons. I mean, first of all, he's a gay man. So, you know, first of all, straight white men aren't allowed to say anything right now. There's this moment in culture where they're just silent. And Buddy's, I mean, I'm a white guy, but I'm not a young guy. And Buddy's a gay man, and he's a gay man from a different generation.
Yeah.
I mean, I come from a generation which went through hell. And I think anybody looks at Buddy or looks at me and goes, God, that guy's got war wounds. And I feel like people have to listen to me. And they have to listen to Buddy because he's legit. Because he's seen such shit. He's seen war. No matter what, people just have to go, you got to give it to the guy. He's mm-hmm. been there. And I think that's a lot of it. So it's kind of an exciting time for me. It's like a superpower to be like a middle-aged white guy who's allowed to talk, say whatever I want as Buddy. And that's very, very powerful right now.
Yeah, and it's also Buddy serves as someone who's keeping that history alive.
Yes, and Buddy, no one owns Buddy. Like, no one owns him. He's his own man. He can't be categorized. He slaps everybody around. He's an equal opportunity offender. And he's authentically himself. And I think people can recognize that.
I just want to let you know that as for my generation of gay men that came of age with the AIDS crisis, as you did, we were extremely inspired by your work.
Thank you.
Me and my friends all sort of became drag queens and got into comedy because of the stuff that you were doing with Kids in the Hall.
That means a lot to me. Thanks. That's nice to hear.
Yeah, it's to me, like, I saw so many people doing Buddy Cole monologues in theater schools and comedy clubs, and especially one of the most important things that you ever wrote, I think, was the one about racism.
Yes, that's the one one of the ones I'm most proud of.
And it ends with, and you say this kind of non sequitur at the end about Yoko mm-hmm. Ono and Malcolm X having lunch at a bistro. I never quite understood what you were trying to say there.
I have no idea.
And there was James Baldwin and someone else.
Maybe James Baldwin's in it too.
No, that was a different one. I remember. But yeah, it's always these disparate characters.
Is that the one where they go, the food's terrible, but the waiter's hilarious?
Yeah, the waiter's hilarious.
That's how you end the racism one. Yeah.
I think that's trying to say is that people will always be fighting. There'll always be millions of points of view. You're always going to have people that are attacking you. But when it gets right down to it, there's nothing like a funny waiter. I think that's it. And that when it gets right down to it, as long as we can laugh, everything's going to be okay. Anybody that brings laughter to the table is a special person, and they should be encouraged. I think that's it. And even if the food's bad, at least you've got a funny waiter.
We get asked this a lot during this podcast, is like, why do gay men, or especially white gay men, share so much language with, as you call it, foxy black mamas?
Oh, yeah. That's...
And part of it is because we're all waiters. You know, we work in restaurants together. We work alongside in the service industry. And so we share a common culture there.
Yes. And I think it's different now. But when I was young, that's why I identify with outsiders. And there were so few gay people in popular culture. I mean, almost no one. That I identified with black culture. I identified with black American culture. I identified with the closest outsiders that I could identify. And so that's how I grew up. And I mean, nowadays it's very different. You have so much gay culture. But back when I was a kid, you did not. So yeah, I think, and a lot of gay men, I think a lot of gay white men took a lot of cues from black women.
And there was that sketch of Homo Alone, of the gay Home Alone outfit, where you had Maude. It was like all of these 70s sitcom stars that came over. And that's sort of like, I don't know, that showed, I feel, to straight audiences, sort of an opening into a world that we may not have understood. And but it sort of like opened and the empathy, obviously, of creating of what and putting the little cans on your feet and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just wish now that gay men could actually admire other gay men. I wish we could get to that stage.
Well, all you got to do is put on pretty ladies' clothes and get on RuPaul's Drag Race. Like,
that's the truth. I mean, really, to get the attention of the gay press, you've got to be either a porn star or a drag queen.
Well, and you certainly no stranger to cross-dressing.
No, I'm certainly not. But I don't perform in drag, and I'm not a porn star. Although I could have been. I think I would have been a good one. But, you know, I just, that's the thing about gay men in comedy. We're still in a stage where there's still not an openly gay male comedy star.
Well, you're certainly the pioneer there for sure.
Well, and I never went to the, I never got mainstream. I've still remained solidly cult. I've never gone to that next level.
How were you able to sell the kids in the hall the idea of doing this openly gay character, Buddy Cole, as a recurring series?
Well, I mean, it was never a scene. At the beginning, it was just I wrote one monologue.
Yeah.
It went very well. And I also realized in the time, this is a, you know, when I was met the kids in the hall, it was the mid-80s. And you could not be an openly gay man in culture. It just wasn't possible. It just literally was not possible. And I wanted to do stand-up comedy at the time, but I had tried a few times. I'd gone to open mics. And the abuse from the audience and the comedians was so terrible that I couldn't handle it.
That's why we all got into performance art in the late 80s
that's
and
right.
early 90s.
You couldn't be.
That's why we took our clothes off on stage,
that's
you
right.
know.
Yes. You couldn't be a stand-up comic. That just would not be allowed. And stand-up comedy was a place for straight men and women. And the women were mostly lesbians.
Yeah.
Even women, there were no straight, almost no straight women. They were almost all dykes. Most of them closeted, but that's the way it was. And when I found Buddy Cole, I found my voice in a way. And I thought, oh, I can do stand-up in a way from a stool as Buddy. And that way I can, and I think that's what happened, is that it became one of the voices of the kids in the hall. And so I think a lot of the other four, they enjoyed, I mean, we're punks at heart. And the other four, they enjoyed the fact that it pissed people off. They loved the fact that it made men angry. You know, Buddy made men angry. And people misunderstood everything we were doing. A lot of guys thought we were sticking it to the fags.
Well, in the late 80s, like, straight guys had to come out of the closet as fans of yours.
Well, actually, that's absolutely true. In fact, most straight men, they would say, oh, I love Bruce, I love Scott, I love Dave, I love Kevin. And they would go, and I like Scott, too. they'd whisper to me, like, going, I don't tell all my buddies this, but I really, you're my favorite. Like, it was a dirty, dark secret if you liked me. You could not openly like me if you were a straight male. And gay men, well, I mean, gay men is fast. I mean,
right. Who does she think she is?
Gay men have a very difficult time elevating another gay male. We're still, I think, lost in self-loathing. We still have a very difficult time elevating another gay male, and unless they're in drag or a porn star. I just think it's kind of sad, to be honest. But there's still no big star. There's no, you know, James Adomian, Joel Kim, Guy Branum. These are all brilliant comics, but none of them are going to the next level. Not yet. None of them have a Netflix special. Like, you know what I mean? None of them are.
We're
none
working
of them are
on
movies.
It, baby. We're listen.
Well, it's happening.
We are going to do this together today.
Quickly.
This
yeah,
ends
today.
Now.
Yeah, I
Good
feel like
ends now, right now.
I feel like if Scott
really
Thompson,
should.
If you walked around like this neighborhood where we are right now, wouldn't he be mobbed?
Yeah.
By, like,
no,
a guy?
God, no. Unless
I swear
I'd be
to God,
if I was with Kathy
this
Griffin,
ends now, Scott. We are going to get you on Netflix.
I swear to you, they would not mob me.
No, I mean, we're in Andersonville, which is the gay part of Chicago or whatever. And
the real gay part.
Yeah,
of
the
Chicago.
Real gay.
There's several neighborhoods.
No.
Yeah. And,
no.
Like, people, when I was like, oh, we're interviewing Scott Thompson, I was so excited. Everyone's like, oh, my God. Like, gay guys were like, oh, my God.
It's nice to hear.
Reading about the kids in the hall, and when it, even when it was harder to find anything about them, about you guys in the 90s and stuff, when it was harder in America to find anything, it was always like, yeah, we're okay, but we're basically Elvis Costello putting the same albums out for the same amount of people. And then it was always like, well, we're Canadian. There was always this thing couched in, it's a very also Midwestern, I feel, is this thing of always making sure that you cut down. And I was
yes,
always like,
absolutely.
But I was like, but you've been in like Star Trek, Voyager, and Hannibal. Like, you have genre credit. Like, you could go to these places and just like sign autographs and take pictures with people.
What Brian is trying to say is that would you consider career signing autographs at Star Trek conventions as
absolutely.
Ambassador Tolman?
I would. I feel like you would. Yeah, you would.
Hannibal's helped me a lot that way.
Yeah, you would get millions of people and Millennium. Which is talked about in the Buddy Babylon book.
Oh, the movie Millennium.
Yes.
Are you kidding me?
That's your hilarious. Starring role in Millennium.
My starring role. They dubbed me, you know that, eh? Not my voice.
Yeah.
They dubbed me. Yeah, I think I sounded too gay.
And then and Buddy had a monologue about it of
I did. I was so angry I wrote a monologue about it.
Yeah, everyone else has made a terrible movie in Canada. Why not me?
Yeah.
You were on Star Trek Voyager.
I was Toman, yes. Yes. And that was the only time I was ever allowed to play straight on American television. And I have to thank Brian Fuller for that. And
you got drunk and you hit on 7 of 9.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't just play straight. I played Mondo straight. I hit on 7 of 9. I mean, that's pretty amazing. Yeah. And I would have loved that. Like, I really was naive back then. I thought, oh, people will be able to see through my open homosexuality, and they'll let me play anyone. They'll let me play serial killers. They'll let me play pussy hounds, like just a straight guy. And I was very naive, but it didn't happen. No, that's the only time I ever got to play straight. It looks like I was always choosing to play gay roles, but that couldn't be further from the truth. That's just all I was given. And I was never given a good gay role. Like, I lost very, very big gay roles to straight actors back then.
What, were you trying to star in Philadelphia?
We know Philadelphia. What a wretched movie. That's a whole plot.
Do we get to watch you die from AIDS in Philadelphia movie. Or something?
You famously said on Conan that you prefer Sharon Stone in Basic Instinct to...
What's a way better movie? No, here's what. I think that my hatred of Philadelphia got me blacklisted by the gay mob.
Really?
I really do, because Philadelphia came out and you were supposed to be in lockstep. You had to agree that this was the greatest movie ever. You had to pretend that that Tom Hanks was giving a good performance. You had to thank the straight world for throwing you a crumb. And if you didn't, you were not part of the gang. And I was quoted in Time magazine as saying that Tom Hanks on his deathbed looks like most of us on a bad hair day. That was the end of me. And I really believe that's when the Pink Mafia said, fuck him, he'll never work again.
Well, that's like that's like that famous Buddy line.
He was one of those faggots that made respectable gays so uncomfortable.
That's exactly it. And it's true. You go back and watch Philadelphia and you'll go, wow, what a bad TV movie.
There were a lot of cameos in that movie.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was chock full of performance art. Karen Finley plays a doctor.
Oh, yes, that's true. Yes, that's true. Yeah.
And she goes up to Tom Hanks, who at this point in the movie has been established that he's blind. And she starts, like, winking at him and like, making facial gestures to her, like, everything's going to be okay.
That's hilarious. I don't even remember that. I remember I almost, watching that movie, I was so angry. I just thought, oh, fuck, how did he get AIDS from sitting on a toilet seat? I mean, it was ridiculous.
That was how everyone got AIDS on, like, yes. TV movies and stuff, was always a blood transfusion. Everyone just
toilet had... Toilet seats must have been filthy.
Everyone had Ryan White AIDS. There was no other type of AIDS.
That's right. So anyways, that's what I think happened. And, you know, I've always been kind of a contrarian, and I marched to my own drummer. And I think that's what happened to me. I think I kind of made some crucial errors in that I took on the wrong people. I mean, I don't feel bad about it. I don't regret it.
So do you feel like you were pink-listed from Hollywood to some degree?
I really believe that, and I'm trying to say that without any bitterness or anger. And I don't know if I'm actually getting there, but that's what I'm working on. But I really believe that. Yes, I do.
I totally know what you're feeling, and I know what that feels like. If you're speaking your mind and sort of like challenging the status quo, it can be extremely unsettling.
Yes, it is. And how can you explain the fact that the kids in the hall, for all that we've done, have never been mentioned by GLAAD? How can you explain that?
Well, do you know that GLAAD was trying to, like, lobby people for the merging of T-Mobile and AT&T, several years ago?
GLAAD is disgusting.
They're sellouts, you know.
They're disgusting. What they are is, they're blackmail artists. That's what they do. They blackmail people. And they're appalling. I think they're so irrelevant. I can't believe who got the Vanguard Award this year. Britney Spears. What a wonderful lesbian.
I was campaigning for you to be the first openly gay man to win a GLAAD Media Award.
Oh God, no! And I won't go. I would love to do it so I could break it over my knee.
So you feel like Buddy Cole, in some ways, has been an armor, not just in dealing with like homophobia from the world, but from being rejected from gay power circles.
Absolutely, absolutely. I actually feel that my armor. I love this. Is a very good point. My armor has to be from both sides. I think the thing I'm most afraid of is my own kind. I'm most afraid of gay men in a group.
I'm so glad that we're talking to you because I just feel like I can, you're throughout your life, I personally can relate so much to what you're going through.
Like there's nothing I fear more than an audience of gay men, which is never going to happen. That just never happens to me. My audiences are mostly straight people. To me, an audience of gay men is like a jury. It's just like, and you're never, and it's stacked again. It's like a white jury and you're a black woman. You're just not going to win.
Now, you re-released your book.
Yes.
Buddy Babylon, the autobiography of Buddy Cole that you wrote with Paul Bellini. And you guys were the sort of the two openly gay comedians and Kids in the Hall.
Yes. Yeah, he's always been my writing partner back then, yep.
And you were in a punk band, Mouth Congress.
Yes, we had a punk band called Mouth Congress. We were the lead singers. We were openly gay punks. Can you imagine that in the 80s?
Who wasn't a gay punk in the 80s?
That is, it is a weird thing because, like, the Kids in the Hall, like, around that time in the early 90s, it was a sea change. Michael Stipe talks about Automatic for the People, when that was released, how much it just felt like there was this change because you were coming out of out of Thatcher and Reagan Bush, and it just felt like something was about to just explode. And it really did in ways of like, and especially just like things that of the type of TV and movies and music that came out, and not just in like the in a gay perspective, but the punk thing that you talked about is Kids in the Hall were like the first comedy troupe that I remember that looked like or like a rock band. Like you guys looked cool in the little interstitials and in your the titles, and you had the like that really cool theme song. Like and you always seem to just never be too overly like silly and like haha, we shouldn't be kind of like taken seriously as actual artists. I know that sounds pretentious.
Yeah, I think that's true. We were very much like that. We absolutely saw ourselves as a rock band. The late 80s, the early 90s are very similar to now. They were a very huge cultural shifts were happening. The Berlin Wall was falling. You know, communist world was falling. Tiananmen Square. You had the AIDS crisis reaching its, you know, peak. You had just so many changes. And I think that's what happened with the Kids in the Hall. We snuck in when things were so uprooting. And we were allowed to do things that would never have been allowed even 2 or 3 years before that. And I think it's a very similar time now. Even political correctness. The late 80s, early 90s, when the Kids in the Hall were on the air in the 90s, political correctness was strangling culture. It was very, very intense. And that's exactly what's happening now. So that's why I feel like Buddy's having a moment now, because it's a perfect time for me and for Buddy and the kind of comedy that I do. Like, I kind of thrive in chaos.
Well, your shows are sold out.
They are. Isn't that crazy?
Yes. Chicago loves you.
Please do another, a couple more, you know, extend your run or something.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to. I mean, these are small theaters, but it's going so well that I think it's going to go. We're going to do another run. And there's talk about it becoming a television special. So that's what I'm really hoping for, finally. It's been a long time. I've been waiting for this.
Yeah, well, you said in an interview that gay men between 40 and 60, you don't believe that they're ever truly going to be whole. And you see, Buddy,
that's really what I believe. I really believe that we're so damaged. We have so much PTSD. We're so wounded.
PTSD, so you called it.
Yeah, we're so wounded and so sad. I know. I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but I just know my friends. And this, you're at this stage of your life and you go, oh my God, now I'm going to start losing everybody again. And that all happened when I was in my 20s. I'm like, oh, I thought I would be prepared for this because of what we went through. And I really do feel like it's almost like gay men, we need like, We need like a million fag march. Like we need an embrace. We need to love each other and to stop this civil war that's happening in our community. We need to stop hurting each other. And we need to forgive ourselves for what and to love ourselves for what we went through and how and we should pat ourselves on the back for making it. And then society should give us a fucking wheelbarrow of money to apologize.
Well, I think that's why Buddy is so great, because, again, he's like living history, but in a fun way. So it's like medicine, yes, with sugar. But he can also say because he's like the sprite who's also like magical. Like he has no, yes, rules. He can do he can do, yes, anything, and he can just he can have Rip Taylor come out of ice and whatever.
Yeah.
But but he can also like talk about, but it's always funny. And like you talk about how Buddy always makes everything about himself.
Yes, and I feel absolutely.
And you say that that's like a stereotypical gay man thing, but I feel like what, yeah, that actually is, and it is because of that, but it's also because there's only, the only thing that Buddy can really control is himself, like in his own self-image.
That's right.
And I feel like that's like why he's so relatable for everyone, because the world is so scary and so big, and what people have been through or whatever, but it's the control that he has is because, and that's why everything is about himself, even when it's like about Putin or whatever. He just wants vodka.
Yes, it is. It's like his whatever you call it, his narcissism, his egotism, his self-centeredness. It's his armor so that he can survive in this world that's always trying to kill him. And, you know, and yet he's a wise person. He's smarter than he wishes he was. I think Buddy maybe wishes he was a little sillier, because it's easier. But it
Scott,
can't help
it. Scott, have you been able to forgive the people who rejected you or hurt you?
Oh, what a good question. That's such a good question, because that is what I'm involved in right now. I'm trying so hard to forgive. Because I have this feeling that if I keep playing my cards right, I might actually get some of the things that I've been chasing forever, that I might actually move to another level in my career, and I might be heard, you know, in a larger audience, which is all what I've always wanted. But I also know that I have so much baggage that unless I jettison that baggage, I'm never going to get the height. And do you know what I mean? Like it's a balloon. I've so much ballast. I need to let go of it because I have so much pain, so much anger towards different people, different institutions, just basically society at large, that in order for me to move past this, especially at my age, I go, I have to start being wise. I have to start being like Gandalf after he falls into the pit, right? Like I've been Gandalf the Grey, but
your bitterness is so hilarious.
And I know.
Part of it is like we have this fear as artists that if we somehow heal ourselves, that, yes, our art won't be as good.
Well, that's okay. You know, I mean, actually, that's going to be all right. I'm at the stage where, okay, I'll nurture this bitterness just a little bit longer until I get that boost. And then I'll heal and I'll become just not funny anymore, but a lovely person. You know, and I feel like I don't want it to sabotage me. And I also have to understand that I'm trying to look back and go, well, everybody was just basically behaving in the way that society told them to behave. And most people are sheep, and almost everybody behaves the way that society tells them to behave. So you have to, and I even about
does
myself.
It help
I also,
being a Canadian living, yes, in Los Angeles is that in some, yes, ways you're like this outsider, and so,
yes,
you can do whatever
God,
you want.
You guys got good points. Yes, absolutely. I think being a Canadian right now in the United States is a very, especially in comedy, or any outsider, it's a very special place to be right now, because this country right now is ripping itself apart. And you need peacekeepers. You aren't capable of solving your problems any longer. You, yeah, need to outsource that to foreigners. And that's what I think is – that's why I think the foreign comics are dominating late night. Like, you know, you have Samantha Bee, Canadian. You have John Oliver, British. You have Corden, British. You know, you have so many foreigners. And you have Jim Jefferies, Australia. You know, like there's always, because I think Americans are kind of lost. And I think that, I think being a Canadian is a very interesting thing to be right now, because most of my life, no one's paid any attention to Canada. It's just like, oh, like America went, I didn't even realize I was wearing a hat. Like, or, oh God, those glasses are on top of my head. But I think people now are looking at Canada and going, God, they're doing something right. And we're like going, what? Don't look at us. No, don't look at us.
Well, you guys have the cutest and most kind Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau.
Let's be honest, the gayest. I mean, I'm not saying he actually has sex with men, but I'll tell you, he definitely went to more gay prides than I did last year. Actually, all he'd have to do is go to one.
It'd be an easy gig for you to sort of, just like George Takei, become the Grand Marshal of Pride Parades every year somewhere in the world.
You'd be surprised.
Does your agent, like, try to kick the head? No. Like, Buddy Cole could be your Grand Marshal for the Gay Pride Parade.
They're not interested. Let's be honest. No one's interested.
But
George Takei came to Chicago and they made him as the Grand Pride Parade Marshal, nobody knew who he was at the time. And people were like, Star Trek, what's that? You know?
Right, right.
And my husband and I got dressed up as Star Trek characters and managed to hang out with him. And we were like kissing him on the cheek. And then those tabloid TV shows bought all the photos. And they were like, the best kept secret in Hollywood, George Takei is gay.
He was the Grand Marshal of the Gay Pride Parade. How much of a secret could that be?
And part of it is like, you know, in some ways, because of your success, it's almost you're sort of outside the gay sphere as an artist.
Well, you know, I honestly feel, I don't feel the connection that I used to feel, I'll be perfectly honest. I really don't.
Well, how's your sex life? Like, do you
terrible.
Get on? Do you get
terrible.
On Tinder or Grindr and
no,
stuff
I don't
like
do any
that,
of that
or Scruff?
No. No, I can't. I'm just afraid that if I did, someone will go, look what Scott Thompson's into. And then they'd publish the whole list of things. I went, I don't want to do that.
Well, I mean, you know, you could do it as Buddy Cole.
Buddy and I don't like the same thing.
You know, I know a lot of like drag queens who go have sex lives as their characters.
Oh, interesting.
And they feel like they can get better dick as their characters than they can out of drag. Sure.
Well, maybe that's interesting. I mean, I don't think anyone's ever come on to me when I'm Buddy.
Well, because you're on stage.
Even off stage. Maybe
you're walking around. Because sort of like you're kind of that character like Elvira or Pee Wee Herman in the sense that like a lot of people might have seen that and thought that was really you.
They do. They quite often, they'll always publish pictures of Buddy and go, Scott Thompson coming. And I'm like, that's not me. I've kind of given up. I'm like, okay, whatever. It's not me, but, you know, oh well. I mean, it's weird. Like, I think, like, when Dame Edna is my favorite comedian of all time, Barry Humphries. And I thought, geez, they never put a picture of Dame Edna and then say Barry Humphries. They call her Dame Edna.
Well, that's a tricky thing, right? Like you're sort of in this kind of gray space. You're not just blurring, you know, in your work, you've blurred gender, but you're also blurring identity here too.
Yeah, because I even have like two, I have two, you know, I tweet as Buddy, I tweet as myself. Sometimes I get into arguments with Buddy. So it is a little weird. But, you know, I guess also with Dame Edna, like Barry Humphries, no one knew him as Barry Humphries outside of Australia. So that he had that. But I would like to get to a place where they just say Buddy Cole coming in, and I don't want my name anywhere. But I don't know if that's going to happen. But that's what I'd like.
In your biography, the Buddy Cole biography, you place Buddy in the center of major political revolutions, like the People's Power Movement that brought down the Marcos regime.
Yes.
And in some ways, he's kind of like this gay, intelligent Forrest Gump character.
Yes.
Where would you like to...
Except smart. Yeah, he's kind of like or Zelig in a way. You know,
well, he's making Buddy popular as opposed to Forrest Gump popular means being outspoken and intelligent popular, which is a really healthy thing to do.
Yeah, yeah, that is part of it. Buddy is like basically Buddy is at the center of everything. And that was part of, that was probably a subconscious way where I was like, well, I don't want Buddy's no sidekick. He's the star. Mm-hmm. So that's part of that was the philosophy that Buddy's the star. He's never the sidekick. He's the star of his life and he's the star of everything.
And so are you.
Well, you wouldn't say that if you saw the way I was dressed in my crappy apartment, but I try to put on a good face.
I feel like the people that really grew up in America, at least the kids in the hall, when it became big, it was probably like a quiet thing that maybe you didn't even realize of the Comedy Central, reruns that were just all like, there's so many people around in their like 30s and that talk about like that they came home, they watched Kids in the Hall and Mystery Science Theater. And with Mystery Science Theater, like they used the Kickstarter and it's like the most successful one in history and got on Netflix. I feel like it is the time for Buddy.
I know. That's what I want. I mean, although I'd drop everything if the Kids in the Hall got another series, if anything, I would drop it in a second.
Will there be a Kids in the Hall reunion? I mean, you guys are all texting each other, and
we're working on it. Yeah, so,
some of the guys don't want to do it because they feel like it's kind of going into the past.
Actually, all five want to do it.
Oh,
everyone wants to do it.
Well, it's just a matter of time then.
Logistics. I think it is a matter of time. Yes. Scott, I think it's a matter of time.
I just want to express so much gratitude and love and affection for you and your work as a gay man and as somebody who can relate to so much of what you've gone through and continue to struggle and succeed doing.
Thank you.
I just want to thank you so much for everything that you've done and for coming on the show and talking with us.
Thanks, guys. I've really enjoyed this. I was a little nervous because I'm always a little nervous when it's a gay thing. And it's, oh God, they're going to have it. You know what I mean? Sometimes gay men can be so mean to each other. You guys have been great and you've asked great questions. And it's, I'm going to say something very, very profound. You're helping me heal and forgive.
Oh, you've helped me heal and forgive. Seriously. I mean, it's like when I was a little gay teenage boy growing up in Puerto Rico, watching you on television, I said, I could grow up to be like you. You know, and we're not that different in age, but you know,
right?
But it was a window.
When I was a little 25-year-old boy,
God, and I always thought one day, God, I can grow up, I'll be Puerto Rican. Like one day, I'll be Puerto Rican if I just hold my breath long enough.
Can we do a little Star Trek cosplay here with you?
Sure.
Travelers who have left the sanctity of their home and family, we welcome you into our home and family.
Thank you. Who's the broad in the skin tight outfit? I want a bit of that.
Yeah. Everybody at home is roaring. The second best thing you've ever done is Ambassador Toman.
Well, you know what's funny? Ambassador Toman is the favorite thing that I ever did. It's the favorite thing for my mother because she loves me being heterosexual. Even though I had a giant blue head and I wasn't even human, at least I was chasing a pretty girl. And my parents were visiting me when I was doing just after Voyager in L.A. And this is a funny story. And I ran into, what's her name? Who played Seven of Nine? Jerry Ryan. In a food court with her daughter, and she was chowing down on fried chicken. Wow. And, you know, it's that body. And my mother met her, and we introduced her, and she was like, oh, she's wonderful. Oh, I hope the two of you get together. I'm like, mother, what are you talking about? Oh, and a beautiful woman like that eating fried chicken? No man can resist that. She was like, a woman with a figure like that that likes to eat? She was like, oh, that's what all men are looking for.
You know, Jerry Ryan saved this country.
Mm-hmm.
How? Did you know? Well, she was married to Jack Ryan, who was running for senator of Illinois against Barack Obama.
You're kidding me.
And during their divorce proceedings, Jeri Ryan spoke about how her husband dragged her to strip clubs.
Sex clubs, they
sex
call
clubs.
It.
Well, it forced her to watch strippers dance on his lap and stuff like that.
Yeah, so he left. He was the Republican, and he left the election, and this guy with a weird name, Barack Hussein Obama, who was a state senator with big ears, just came in, and the Republicans couldn't. They tried to get former coach of the Chicago Bears, Mike Ditka, to run, and he refused, and then, like, Alan Keyes, the conservative commentator, finally came in, and he just got destroyed because it was like 2 weeks to the election or something. But that's how Barack Obama was able to just swing into the Senate. And that's your former wife, Scott, Jeri Ryan.
The woman I should have married to save this country.
Well, there's still time.
There is still time. Maybe we can get together and run on a ticket next on 2020. I'll get my citizenship.
Toman 7.
Is it hard to go visit your family in Canada and back in? Because you live in LA right now, right?
I live in LA. I'm going home on Thursday for 12 days. Not really. No, I go home as much as I can, though, because my mom's not well. But I go back as much as I can. That's all right. Mm-hmm. I go back as much as I can.
And one thing I wanted to touch on before we leave is it's you had your own scare with cancer.
Yes, I did. I had cancer. Yes.
And the hardest thing about cancer is,
what's that?
Is answering questions about cancer.
Thank you. Good night.
It's like I just went through skin cancer, a really bad skin cancer where they chopped off part of my shoulder.
Right.
And it's like at first I was like, oh, I'm getting all this attention, you know, and then suddenly you're like, stop talking to me about this.
Stop talking about cancer. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, you know, we lived throughout our whole lives sort of like with HIV and AIDS as this grim reaper, you know, and suddenly like cancer comes out of nowhere. And
I know.
You're just like, what?
Listen to this. This is a good thing to end on. When I told the boys that I had cancer, this is how they reacted. Well, okay. Bruce said, what? You don't have AIDS? I said, no. He goes, are you kidding me? Holy fuck. How dare you?
You are so blessed to have such good people in your life.
I'm very lucky. You know, and then of course we're laughing, I'm crying, but I'm like, God, I love those guys.
Yeah. I love you.
And well, yeah, thank but you, you also, I had seen you when you and Kevin toured, you turned that cancer thing into like an amazing, like 20-minute bit about how much you felt like a woman and the pink paper and all that.
Oh, yes. And that turned into a really beautiful 20-minute piece that really is worked on now. And that'll be in my new album. Yeah. I have my first comedy album coming out called Not a Fan. And it's that was the cancer thing was what turned me on to society turning on men and the rise of women and the new, well, I mean, I don't know how to say it, but female homophobia, does that make, right? Which is a good place to leave on because I want people to see that in the show.
Well, please come back when your album is out.
Thank you. I will.
I absolutely adore you. You're such a charmer.
Thanks. You guys are charming.
If I saw you on Tinder, I'd swipe right.
Oh, thank you. Maybe I'll get on right now. Okay.
Take care, Scott.
Thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, guys. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Scott Thompson lives in Los Angeles, California. His beloved character, lounge lizard Buddy Cole from Kids in the Hall, is back in Après le Déluge, After the Flood, the Buddy Cole monologues, an evening of humorous stories and quips from the period the show went off the air, 1995 to the present day. The show comes to Chicago starting May 30 as part of the Onion Comedy Festival. Learn more about it on our website, Feast of Fun. So, Brian.
Yes.
How was that? They say never meet your heroes, but I think in this case, it was a hero worth meeting.
Yeah, that was I thought that was great. I thought that went wonderful.
Hey, keep your dick in your pants.
Yes, I tried to stay out of it because he's had enough straight guys fawning over him.
You were really like halfway through the interview, you're like, let me tell you how awesome you are.
Well, because I always feel it's always weird reading about like it. I don't know. Like I believe that he.
You're a little verklempt right now.
Yeah, I believe that
short for words.
it's not that I don't believe, like, that he has had people, like, turn him down or whatever it was, but I always, like, just get this feeling that maybe he doesn't understand how, like,
there's
because
a little bit of that. I throughout my course of my life, my parents and my friends and family have always been like, you are so gay. Why do you have to be so gay? You know, if you were like doing more straight stuff, you'd be more successful. And I'm kind of like, you know, because I have no other option to be who I am. And so hearing Scott sort of relating his story to us in the interview is something really empowering for me, because I know what that feels like, you know. And largely, we've given so much publicity and press to so many TV shows and movies and artists and stuff. And, you know, as soon as those, like RuPaul's Drag Race is a great example. As soon as that show sort of became this mainstream juggernaut, a lot of media companies have actively pushed us out from being able to interview RuPaul or the contestants of the show. And it's only because of our reputation and the love of the audience and the love of drag queens who love this show that we're able to do anything with any of them these days. Because, you know, it's like a Viacom and MTV and a lot of the bars put in their writers that we can't talk to them anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's like this idea that, like, you know, we get more hate and more obstacles coming from inside our own community than outside of it. Like, when you look at the comments on For Feast of Fun on the iTunes Music Store, for example, all you see is negative stuff coming from the gay perspective. It's not coming from, like, a right-wing Christian fundamentalist or somebody who is rejecting us because they see our sexuality as sinful. They're rejecting us because we're outspoken, because we're bold, because we're independent.
I think that's because the standard default of, like, gay men in that's shown, like, the stereotype is the bitchiness. And so that's what rises to the surface. So it sort of makes other, like, gay people maybe growing up in that type of thing think mm-hmm. that they have to sort of compete with that. So they try to, so it sends from the top down. It creates a whole type of thing,
hierarchy.
Like, of like, this is how we are. So, like, everyone act like this. And then you do that because you want to be noticed.
It's a playbook.
But also, yes, but also, like, oftentimes the way to get people's attention, the best way, is by saying negative shit. That's when you, not like the best way in healthy,
it's
but
an
I mean to
way
get a
to be,
person
to get attention, but it's also not a very, it's not a long term kind of attention that feeds you into the future.
No, but if somebody's like nice, yeah. a lot of times people will just like smile and maybe not respond. But if they're like, hey man, you really suck or whatever, people will respond to that. And you see it on Twitter all the time with celebrities. Like, people will retweet or say things to people who are terrible to them. But then if you like see all the stuff of like, hey, I loved your show or whatever, they might get a fave or something like that, but not, you won't engage with them. Not you, just people
in
general.
I made this rule with myself, and I try to sort of impose this rule on Mark and other gay men that come our way. It's like, you know, maybe like the 10% rule is like, if you spend a certain amount of time engaging with somebody negatively, you have to spend, you know, 9 times more, 90% of your time engaging with people positively in an affirmative way. So it's like, what did you do today to engage with somebody who supports and loves your work?
I also feel like it's just so much more fun to enjoy things and to like stuff. So
yeah.
While, like, when I see a movie that I don't like, I try to never hate a movie. Quentin Tarantino had this thing of, like, never hate a movie because you can always take something from it. There's not many things that you can't take something from it, even if it's, like, the thing of, like, oh, now I know not what to do, or now I know I don't want to see that. Even if you see a terrible movie, usually then telling someone about this terrible movie makes them laugh and mm-hmm. yourself laugh with how enjoyable it is to discuss, like, this crazy bad movie you saw. So I feel like that in and of itself makes it a worthwhile thing. You don't have to go back to it, but you don't have to like spend so much time just being angry at things.
Well, I feel like right now with Scott Thompson, we're in a really magical moment because he's right on the cusp of becoming a huge star again. And this is very similar, this interview. If you guys go back to our site and listen to our interview with George Takei before he became this, you know, media juggernaut.
Ooh.
He was kind of hurting. He was kind of in this like limbo that Scott Thompson's coming out of. And I predict in a year from now, there's no way that we'll get Scott Thompson again on the show just because he's going to, you know, his star is going to blow up so much. And so part of me, and I understand like from the perspective of our audience, is that like I'm a fan of Scott's, and there's this bittersweet situation is that we have access to him because he's in this like celebrity limbo right now. And as soon as his career and his, you know, he has sold out shows, his book, the re-release of his book is selling very well. And it's going to be hard for us then to sort of get close enough in a show, for example, in a small little theater, or having him on the podcast, because he's going to be this kind of untouchable big star like George Takei is now.
Maybe.
And so people who listen to this podcast in a lot of ways, they sort of maybe on an unconscious level try to not tell their friends about the show. They don't tell people about Feast of Fun because they're sort of, you know, don't want us to not be reachable or relatable to them in some degree. And it's this idea, like if you're a fan of an artist or a band or a comedian, you kind of you guard it very close to your heart and you don't want other people to know about it, because then you sort of lose a little something about it when they become these big stars.
Well, and you also want to choose who gets to who you do share it with. But I feel like talking about Scott's going to become bigger than ever and we're not going to get him back. That's why it's nice to just think of like what we just, how we just were able to have that. Like,
yeah, it was a great moment.
We could also just die tonight in our sleep or whatever, and then nothing happened. Like, who knows?
Well, I gotta get the show up before I die.
Yeah, but like,
sometimes it feels that way, you know? It's like, it's a lot of work to like edit and post this content on a daily basis. And sometimes I'm like, must put out the podcast before I.
Oh no, Jesse, help.
Jesse, start typing.
Click, 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 click.
You know, and another thing I want to sort of talk about with you is our friendship, you know, as gay men and straight guys, straight identifying guys.
Oh, yeah.
It's always a temporary state, right?
Today, yes.
It's something really great to, you know, because we're sort of rejected by our families. And my mother always says this, it's like, find father figures, find brothers, find people that you can recreate your family with. And, you know, it's just been great.
It's a RuPaul thing, right?
RuPaul says that, but, you know, people have been saying that for decades.
Yes.
Now she's just sort of mainstreaming that. And we get to choose our own families. And it's really great to sort of work with you, Brian, and sort of, you know, sort of showcase your skills to our audience, but also be part of your scene and your sensibility. And in a lot of ways, like what we do here is very much to me, very influenced by what the kids in the hall did. And so it's just a matter of time before we put you in a pretty dress.
Oh, well, heels. That's what I would talk like. I would wear
it. So you know how to tuck your dick between your panties and stuff?
Yeah, I know how to tuck my dick. It's not like it's not that hard.
It's hard, honey.
Nice. But yeah, like
dick
if
pantyhose,
if there was a reason that I needed to be in a dress, like they needed to wear dresses.
There's never a reason not to.
Oh, okay. Sometimes I like jeans, I guess.
What color do you like to wear?
Black. It's lame.
No, black is not black is not editorial. You can't wear black, you can't wear white.
Black's not editorial. What do you mean?
Because the black is kind of a neutral color or neutral image, and it also absorbs light. It doesn't show the shape of the dress. So, like, you sort of need bold colors or, you know, lighter tones to showcase what the figure looks like. So when you're dressing up in drag,
I don't have a good figure.
Well, that's what drag is about, is subverting what the way you look like and creating this idealized feminine version of yourself.
No, that's your idea of what drag is. Drag can be whatever I want it to be.
You can.
Yes, because I'm subverting what you're saying drag is. The reason I'm going to do drag is because there's no rules.
Well, I think
I'm turning it on its head.
The inspiration for drag is to create an idealized version, idealized feminine version of yourself. And certainly drag can be anything you want it to be. But, you know, I think a lot of motivation for that is sort of living outside of your own self, on your own reality. And that's part of the reason why, like, Buddy Cole wins as a character, because he is not Scott Thompson and he is Scott Thompson at the same time. It's this ability, it's this avatar for him to be able to do and say the outrageous things that he wants to be.
Buddy Cole also doesn't, he like laughs about the stuff. He's not, everything is kind of like a joke to him, in the sense of he can laugh off everything. Like, he thinks things are ridiculous. Like the mm-hmm. The stuff about, like, there was about Andrew Dice Clay and Eddie Murphy and Sam Kinison, and how homophobic they were in one of his monologues. He just like is like laughing at like how ridiculous they are, and yeah. just and make and like mocking them, and it's like, it doesn't hurt me at all. Like, I don't give a shit. Like, who, like, why is it all the ugly, whatever losers that think that guys can't wait to fuck them or something? It was, and so, and then just like mocking them is always like almost a steel proof way of getting people, like, they feel worse. if they come at you and you just mock them, and you're yeah. able to do it in a way that hits them in a like a real way and get other people to laugh at them, it is very, very powerful. And that's one of like the great aspects of Buddy Cole, is that even when he's saying things that are quote unquote political, it's always said with this thing of like, can you believe this shit? And it always feels like he's just a guy talking at like a dinner, like, ugh, these people.
Well, that's the power of comedy, right? It's the ability to sort of fight back in a way that's asset oriented, that, you know, in some ways you're fighting back, but you're also lifting the spirits of even the oppressor themselves. If they're able to heal from this, they're also able to laugh at the situation.
But it's hard to do without getting too like angry or something, where things, or just like the comedians like Bill Maher, who just say something and it's not even a joke or funny, but then the audience just applauds, and like he thinks he's going to say a joke. And he's like, Trump is dumb.
Bill Maher was never really that funny to begin with. You know, before people, he started doing his talk show. Yeah.
Comedians say like a political thing and then people applaud. They don't laugh. They will applaud because they agree with it. And it's just like, this is dumb.
I remember this one time, this comedian, she stood up on stage and said, "Hey guys, guess what? I'm pregnant." And everyone's like, "Yay, congratulations." And she's like, stops and goes, "Not for long."
Nice.
And I was just like, it was such a great moment in comedy to see this whole room of people's bubble popped. And we, you know, and instantly we start becoming aware of how we're imposing these expectations on a woman and her body, you know, just by sort of cheering her on her pregnancy. And then she's just like pulling the rug from under us. And it's such a great thing to have. I'm really jealous that I'm not going to be able to see Scott Thompson's show here in Chicago.
I'm probably not going to be able to see it either.
Weasel our way in somehow, staying outside. So. Hey, Scott, remember me? It's Fausto.
Hey.
It's Andrew Dice Clay.
Hey, you want to be Puerto Rican?
Through marriage. I think I'm like a little bit embarrassed myself, because he's such a charmer and he's such an inspirational figure for us. You know, we're like at the end of the interview, we're like, "We'll suck your dick, Scott. We love you. We'll do anything."
Yeah. Like, and I kept like, yeah, it's hard for me not to just have an entire interview where I'm like, "No, you are the greatest. Here's all the reasons why you're great."
Well, and I think it's really tempting to sort of believe that fandom, you know, you want to sort of be very objective about your work. And if you lose yourself in the group of people that celebrate you, you kind of become an asshole, right?
I mean, you can, I guess, or you can become like, I don't know, John Waters or something, where he speaks mostly to his fan base. Like, yeah. He goes off to whatever and will do things, but he's always John Waters. But like the people,
John, like, Waters is a bit of a crank, I would say, like, unnecessarily so.
Mm.
And he's very warm and sweet with the people he wants to be warm and sweet with, but with people he suffer fools lightly. Or is that the expression?
Yes. Or he doesn't suffer fools.
And I've seen him in situations where he's just like, get away from me, kid, you know?
and he was nice to Homer.
Well, on The Simpsons as a character, yes. Yeah.
No, that was John Waters. You are the living end.
Oh, Homer.
He prefers the company of men. Who doesn't?
And part of me is like, that's been something that I've made a pact with myself, is like, no matter where I go as an artist, is to be generous and kind to people who are strangers, I don't have anything to gain from, the everyday person, because I think that's the right thing to do. And it's also, it keeps you humble and it keeps you wise in some ways. I try to be a wise person, you know, and it's a goal to be. And I see too many, you know, lost souls in some ways, and, you know, who are very successful in entertainment, but they strike me as very empty or very desperate and unhappy. And I think happiness comes from your ability to be kind to people, no matter who they are.
And Scott Thompson has the vulnerability, yeah, that is very nice and refreshing, and explaining, like, in sort of thinking of his answers, like, of, and trying to forgive and get over the bitterness and things like that. It's a, and just how he feels about the gay, and, like, that he's nervous around a group of gay men. And I am,
believe me, I'm nervous around a group of gay men too. They're, yeah, the mean girls, you know.
You know it's going to hurt and you won't be able to sit for a week. I'm nervous when I'm getting lubed up. And
I'm like, all right, which one of you guys is going to stick your dick in me first?
Let's start sounding. Oh, ting.
Ding.
Oh, I'm sounding. But yeah, like, I wonder also, because he talks about how, like, he has a straight following for the most part. He doesn't have gay guys that like him.
Well, there are more straight people than there are gay people. And so if you reach, yes, mainstream success, like if you're on television, the vast majority of your audience is going to be straight identifying people.
But also he's with four straight guys. And the majority, regardless of how much we think Kids in the Hall is just almost like all just gay comedy, the majority of it all is not. It's not even like relationship or any type of sexual comedy in Kids in the Hall. Most of them are just, mm-hmm, like sketches and normal, like, just comedy sketches. And then there's like Buddy Cole, and there's a lot for a quote unquote like normal sketch show of gay humor. But the reason it sticks out is because it's not normal for a sketch comedy troupe to have so much gay humor, but there's not as much as we think it is. So I feel that that's why, like, straight people go to it more, and also possibly why Scott isn't as comfortable around gay people, because he's been so, like, immersed with straight people.
Well, it's also you're sort of like, gay men can be like Siamese fighting fish, those beta fish that you get at the grocery store, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You put two in the tank together, they kill each other, but they're both kind of like drag queens. They prim and prompt, you know. If you put a mirror in front of them, they love looking at their reflection.
Whereas, like, lesbians are the opposite, right? Because, like, women are just better in general.
I don't know. You know, lesbians have this sort of idea that if it's lesbian, it's okay. And there's a political bent to supporting female artists that gay men just don't have.
Yeah. Scott Thompson said, gay men and lesbians, we are kind of fake allies. The only people that think of us as allies are straight progressive people. We hate each other. We have zero in common. Everything we want, they want to stop. We're like cats, and we are like, they're like cats.
Are you talking about the animosity between gay men and cisgendered lesbians?
Yes, he says they're like cats and we are like dogs, playful puppies ignoring the rules. And if they're, and they're like, no, that's not the right way to do things. And they're usually on a bullhorn.
You know, I think it's one thing that I've seen in my lifetime shift. Well, I came from an age where gay men and lesbians were united in fighting discrimination and AIDS.
That was
a rare moment in history, right?
Yeah.
And then so that as the AIDS crisis sort of lifted, gay men and lesbians sort of went their separate ways, and there was like animosity about this. And we sort of had common ground in fighting for marriage equality, right? It was a lesbian couple, it was a surviving lesbian, whose lawsuit brought about marriage equality. So we have to be very smart and intelligent and honoring the contributions that lesbians have given us in our equality. But then there's also been this sort of
oppressive, negative,
with, you know, with especially, you know, cisgendered lesbians, or they call themselves TERFs, right? Trans radical exclusionary feminists, or
trans exclusionary
radical feminists, in their desire to say that lesbians or women are only women who are assigned female at birth and have a certain set of genetics and physical attributes. And if you don't match those, then you're not really a woman.
Well, I know lesbians apparently, or I've read and heard that lesbians also feel that gay men never have lesbians' backs, and lesbians are expected to have gay men's backs. And like when,
about the rich, you know, yeah, the,
well,
Brian,
no, what I'm
Fullers,
talking about, uh-huh. Well, what I'm talking about is with the AIDS crisis and how lesbians were there for gay men, but for things like breast cancer, gay men are not there for lesbians.
Well, and part of it is that, you know, I think we're all fighting for healthcare, and I think fighting for breast cancer is fighting for healthcare. And
yes, but that's because
I would say
affects,
like, all LGBT people are fighting for those things equally.
Yes, but that's because it affects gay men as well. But when it's something that's mostly affecting gay men, the lesbians were there. When it's something mostly affecting women, the gay men weren't there. Is what I'm saying. I've seen.
Yeah, I think
I've
marching
seen the problem.
in a parade, I don't think is a good measure of people's contribution to some degree. I think, you know, there's been extraordinary conversations and money put behind women's health issues, especially in Chicago, with the Howard Brown Health Center and the Lesbian Community Cancer Project, or now Lesbian Care Community Project. You know, there's certainly a lot of good examples where gay, rich, white men have stepped up and supported and given generously to women's health issues.
And what about Puerto Rican men?
Are you talking about me? I've supported plenty of Lesbian Community Cancer Project benefits in drag.
Communicans? Is that what you call cancer? Breast cancer?
So I don't think it's fair. Cancer. And part of it is like, you know, I think that there's this idea, this critical culture that we have where we're always looking for ways that we fail to meet each other and not looking for ways that we support and rise to the occasion. And I think it's important to really celebrate those triumphs that we've managed to get in our course of our lifetimes. You know, the AIDS crisis is something that's very complicated right now because we have this medication where you can take Truvada and it makes becoming HIV positive a very unlikely thing to happen to you.
Is that PrEP?
PrEP, yeah. It's like 99.9% effective. And then there's the, you know, marriage equality. We in this day and age are able to legally be married to the person we love and benefit from the protections and the tax benefits of that happening.
Yeah, lesbians trying to shove monogamy into gay men's lives. Ugh,
and you know,
and
Scott Thompson says it's in some ways it's, you know, we're still not acknowledging the sexual revolution that gay men have been able to bring upon society. And those things take a little bit longer time because they're messier. They're more wilder. They're more on the on the fringes of society. But ultimately, you know, as Martin Luther King Jr. says, the arc, the stream of What is it?
The stream of piss.
The stream of
bends
piss
towards bends towards a garbage can. I forget. I know that it's wrong. Like the way that Obama uses the quote is, and how it's actually like a Baptist.
The arc of justice.
It's the arc of justice, or the arc of history is along with it bends towards justice. But it's something about like it's actually a quote about how people need to come to Jesus. So it's not a good quote for people to use.
It's not like, you know, our time will come and we need to stick together and work through these things.
Power to all the power to all the people.
And if I can leave people with anything, because we should wrap this up here, is the power of forgiveness. It's the right thing to do, but it's also a way to empower yourself. And you know, Oprah likes to talk about this, is that, and Tyler Perry says in his movies, it's, you don't have the power to hurt me anymore. But forgiveness is also the ability to be generous and to say, you hurt me bad, but I still forgive you because I need to move forward with my life. It doesn't mean that, you know, like the person gets away with it or that somehow you have to stick around and put up with their abusive behavior.
You don't even have to talk to them ever again.
No, it's you just have to say, I forgive you. You know, and for all those people who have sort of bullied or said negative things or, you know, organizations that have muscled us out of opportunities or denied us, or people have stolen content from us or, you know, harmed us in some degree, I have to forgive them, because otherwise I'm going to just be sitting here in my apartment stewing every day about how this opportunity or that opportunity passed me by. But I'm surrounded by really extraordinary good people like you.
Who?
And
Jesse?
Guests like
and Jesse.
Scott Thompson and our dog and my husband, who I don't know where he is right now.
I think he's in the bathroom. I think Mark's been in the bathroom for like a week.
And I'm surrounded by really great people, and I have a really great life, and it's, you know, the future is really bright. I gotta wear shades.
Ooh, it is so bright. Yeah, I wear my sunglasses at night also. And he's a Canadian, Corey Hart.
When you were angry, like in your youth, did you ever like scream, sing Corey Hart songs, Never Surrender? I did.
No, I never did. I was too angry. He's one of the people I refuse to forgive.
And when it's cold and dark at night, you can see light. Never surrender.
Well, he should take his shades off.
Then you can see it.
It's so dark.
Stop running into walls.
Wait, why is it so dark at night?
Remember, folks, Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous, fierce people like you. Consider becoming a member and listen to our past shows, like with George Takei or Terry Sweeney.
Oh my.
Pioneering gay men in comedy, available on our website, feastoffun.com/plus. Or if you want to make a tip, put a tip in the tip jar.
Come up and see me sometime.
Go to feastoffun.com/donate. Your financial support makes it happen. If you are a member and your credit card changed, your membership will be canceled. So please keep that in mind. We're going to send you an email and say, hey, we need your support. Don't go away.
And
please come back.
If you want to see the Scott Thompson Star Trek Voyager episode, it's Someone to Watch Over Me, Season 5, Episode 21, I think.
We can put a link up that on our website if it's on I think there's clips of it on YouTube, right?
You got to... I was watching it on Netflix. You can see it on Netflix, but maybe there's clips on YouTube. You got to do Captain Janeway to an actual Star Trek Voyager star.
Such a good moment.
So many dreams came true today. Have you ever had a Star Trek? Well, you had George Takei who was on an episode of Star Trek.
But we didn't
Voyager.
Do any cosplay.
Oh, yes. Oh, my.
Chakotay, tell Seven to come into my ready room.
Okay, Captain, I will.
Captain, why do they call this your ready room? Because Seven, I think you're ready for your first Borg-gasm.
Naomi Wildman, come in here.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.